Our collection includes 36,000 ethnographic pieces, 535,000 archaeological pieces, and over 600 pieces in the Kroner Ceramics Gallery. There's a lot to take in. Luckily, at the Museum of Anthropology, final exams are always take-home. If you've never checked out this world-class facility, now's your chance. The Museum of Anthropology is located right on campus and free for all UBC students and faculty. Come enjoy our collection and resources.
To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people. And so long as men die, liberty will never perish. Soldiers, don't give yourselves to brutes. Men who despise you, enslave you, who regiment your lives, tell you what to do, what to think, and what to feel, who drill you, diet you, treat you like cattle, use you as cannon fodder. Don't give yourselves to these unnatural men, machine men with machine minds and machine hearts. You are not machines. You are not cattle. You are men.
Welcome, everybody. This is a Room Tone, the radio show, and here we are talking movies because we love it on 101.9 FM CITR Radio, broadcasting from Ancidum Musqueam Land here at UBC. What a beautiful day here. Be so happy to be joined by legendary director, instructor, and mentor, Nicholas Humphreys. How are you doing, Nicholas, today?
I'm fantastic. Thank right you so much
on.
For having me.
Right on. It's a pleasure to have you here, and I'm very, very happy to bringing back an instructor of mine, and I'm very, 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 I feel honored, you know? It's a very special moment. And with this being said, I want to ask you, first things first, who are you? For the people out there who don't know you yet, who are you?
Okay. Well, hi, everybody. My name is Nick Humphreys, and I am a Vancouver independent film director. I've been directing for about 12 years now. So I started, of course, in short films and then made a brief kind of departure into web series when I was doing my master's thesis here at UBC. That web series was what helped me make the jump into feature film. So I've directed 3 feature films now, most recently one that I shot in Sudbury, Ontario, with a fantastic crew out there. And I also teach film. I teach directing at Vancouver Film School. I've taught directing and producing at UBC, and I do a lot of mentoring in town. So I do mentoring with the National Screen Institute for Story Hive and stuff like that. And that's kind of who I am.
That's awesome right there. And we're going to get to explore and get to know you a little better, but let's take it slow. We have a beautiful hour of chat here on this radio show and podcast. And with this being said, one of the biggest questions that I have for you is actually related to you as an instructor and mentor. I know that you have a lot as a director to share, and we'll get there. But as an instructor and mentor, what is the ingredient that really makes a student success in their own meaning of success?
Oh, man. You know, I think hard work. I hate the word talent. Mm-hmm. Because I think that, you know, it's kind of, there's this false narrative around like people like show up on the scene and they just have it, right? And because we like those kinds of stories, they're exciting, but what that doesn't encapsulate is all of the hard work and the failure and the, you know, making mistakes and learning and stuff like that, that goes into every single success. So I think no matter where you're starting from as a student, we all start somewhere. And if you're willing to put in the work and be able to recognize where you need to grow, anybody can get where they're going.
Mm-hmm. Growth is a key word right there. What about your personal growth?
My personal growth. Well, I've made a share of mistakes along the way. I don't have a plan B. I've spent my entire adult life pursuing a singular dream, which is to become a director. And, you know, not having another option means that I have to keep pushing forward. I have to keep trying. I have to move on to the next thing and see where I need to do better and tackle those things with the next project.
That's awesome right there. Thank you for sharing that. And I feel that leaves us with with a doubt, you know, or with the curiosity to explore a little further.
Yeah.
And that's what was the step, or what was the transition between filmmaking as a hobby and filmmaking, you know, as an actual craft, you know, and bringing you into it as an actual director who was chosen to direct feature films. What was that transition like?
Oh man, well, I mean, I should preface this, and I think I'd be doing a disservice if I you know, lied about this at all, but it took me 10 years to get paid as a director. And I never thought that it was something that I could do as a career. I thought this was always going to be a hobby. It was something I was going to do with my friends and stuff like that. And it came down to one of my very first short films I did for like $0 in my apartment, and just thought I would send it out to a festival. And the National Screen Institute at the time had a film festival called the Film Exchange. And I sent it to them, and it won the Audience Choice Award, which blew me away, because we maybe spent $20 on pizza to feed the crew to make this thing. And it was the first time I realized that, you know, like, maybe I can make stuff that people are connecting with and that people like, and I should continue to pursue this. You know, I just pushed through, and I produced a high volume of work over the past 10 years. And I kept, you know, trying different genres and different formats, and trying web series and stuff like that before making the jump to features. So mm-hmm. I think just, yeah, getting your hands dirty on everything and not taking no for an answer, I think eventually people are going to start paying you for it, mm-hmm. because you've spent enough time studying it, and you know, you do become the person that gets known for that thing. Mm-hmm. I personally have spent a lot of time branding myself as a genre director, someone who's into horror and dark fantasy and sci-fi. So, you know, I think when scripts are greenlit and they have that that script, they're thinking of me because I've marketed myself that way. And I think that's an important piece of the puzzle as well.
Mm-hmm. Sounds great right there. We crossed something in that little extract. There was something very interesting to me, which is the importance of recognition. Mm. And I wonder what would have happened to Nicholas Humphreys if maybe he didn't receive that recognition from the film festival, right? So how important is for filmmakers that sense of recognition of the hard work? How important do you feel that is for someone to grow?
Oh, man. Well, for me, it was really important. You know, I think it might be a while before you get that, right? Ira Glass talks about this thing called the creativity gap that I love, where it's like we all come to, you know, the artistic process, whether it's making films or you know, writing or painting, whatever it is, because we've got good taste, and our standards of what is good is way up here. The radio people can't see what my hands are doing right now. But, you know, we have good taste and we want to make those kinds of things, and our experience and the budgets we're playing with, you know, we're not making things at that level. And there's a sense that, you know, the value of what we're doing isn't that great. But everybody starts down there, and the people that succeed are the ones that survive that gap. And the only way to survive that gap is to fight your way through it and produce a high volume of work. And eventually you're going to get to that point where you're making stuff that, you know, you consider has value.
Mm-hmm. So the only way to create content is to create more content, basically.
Just keep pumping it out.
Yeah. It's a chain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And learn from your mistakes.
Absolutely. And yeah. What about that process of learning from your mistakes? Is there something specific about your journey that you'd like to share related to that process of making mistakes?
Oh, gosh. I mean, it's such a tough balance when you're a filmmaker, because, you know, you have to, on the one hand, have this unshakable sense of confidence. And on the other hand, you know, really be able to look at what you did wrong. And I look at like pretty much everything that I've done, and I'm just like, oh, I should have done that differently. I should have done that differently. And I think that's just like a really important part of the process is, mm-hmm. you know, like be able to recognize those things and learn from it, and then try not to make the same mistake twice. Mm-hmm. But I think there's always going to be that thing. And it's a good thing if it is, because it means that, you know, you're recognizing those things and getting to grow.
Mm-hmm. Is there a specific way you look back at your work?
Oh, you know what I find really handy is when, like, if I'm in post-production on a project and I've been staring at it for a really long time, I will just bring somebody new into the room to watch it. And just the act of having somebody in that space that's seeing it with fresh eyes will allow me to see it with a kind of fresh eyes, which allows me to then dig back in and make changes, because, you know, you get to a point in post-production where it just, you've been staring at it for so long, it just, you know, you don't even know if it's, it has, if it's good, or if you're telling the story that you set out to tell. So
this is very important. What you just said is something that really resonates, and I personally experienced having someone who hasn't watched the movie in the room.
Yeah.
Triggers a certain type of awareness in yourself while you're watching that movie. And this is something, it's very interesting, try and explore the motivations behind it and how that works. But if you watch the movie on your own, it's just not the same thing.
Yeah.
It's just not the same thing.
Yeah.
That's interesting. And that proves how the need of social interaction, you know, in our species, you know, and also in the community. We have such a beautiful community here in Vancouver. How have you seen it transform in the past 10 years?
The community?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, actually, I had a really kind of amazing moment last night. There was a screening at the Rio Theater, and it was a selection of films that had been greenlit with StoryHive funding, and a bunch of the filmmakers got together and pooled resources to rent out the theater. And there was such a diversity of A, content, but also B, like the types of voices in the room was really, really diverse. And yet the Rio is a huge theater, and it was packed. Right. So it's like you've got these singular, you know, unique voices now that didn't exist 10 years ago. I mean, it was a very whitewashed, cisgendered type of culture. And now it's so diverse, but the community is one. Right. And everybody was coming out and applauding each other's work and supporting each other. And it was an emotional thing to be, you know, me sitting up in the balcony, you know, 12 years after starting this, watching this community come out and support each other. The independent film scene in Vancouver is, it's just, it's a wonderful place to be an artist. And I think, yeah, it's just, there's never been a better time to be a filmmaker, no matter who you are. You know, anybody can make a film now, and people are going to celebrate it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes in little, you know, theaters in Vancouver, and then those things are going to go on the internet and people are going to share them. It's just
beautiful. It's sense of acceptance here in Vancouver.
Yeah, yeah.
Beautiful. And then that's where we meet another line. Coming from Italy with such a structured culture, you know, there seems to be this big dilemma, you know, in my mind. And where does diversity fit in, and where does integration fit in? Mm. There seems to be this big, big contrast, because I feel Vancouver, and this is Vancouver in general, it's a little bit like hormonal teenager, you know. It has its own aspects to it. It's always changing. It's still finding its own identity, and that's when integration comes in and might help. Mm. But at the same time, it will lose the fascination of diversity. Where do you think is the balance when it comes to places like Vancouver?
Oh man, well, I think we're always going to be kind of finding our own identity in a place like Vancouver, and that's, you know, I think the benefit of being such a multicultural city is that new people and new voices are constantly being added to the equation, which means, you know, there's never going to be, you know, a picture of what a Vancouverite looks like. You know, and I think that's true for most of Canada as well. Mm-hmm, it's like there's mm-hmm. no, like, you know, atypical, you know, like a Canadian sort of persona. Mm-hmm. Our identity is that we are multicultural, and, you know, we are inclusive, and I wouldn't want to live any other way.
Mm-hmm. And where do you think that line exists in feature films, especially your feature films? I'd really like to hear about your feature films and your adventures. And where is that line between the creative and rational aspect of filmmaking for you?
Oh, man. I mean, I make genre films, right? Like, I make horror movies because I love horror movies. And so I think there's a, you owe the audience a certain formula, right? So that they get what they paid for. Because film is also a business. And so we're sort of operating within that structure when we make horror movies. At the same time, we want to surprise people. We don't want to give them the same thing they've seen a million times. So it's like you really do have to find that balance of, like, practicality and ingenuity when you're making a genre film that, it's not an easy thing. But I actually like the structure. I think is a good thing, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it allows us to be more creative if we know what the sandbox is that we're playing in.
Of course, you need the limits to actually be fully creative. It limits emphasize creativity.
Yeah,
is that what you're saying?
Yeah,
yeah.
I think okay. That's what I'm gonna say.
Yeah, it's I mean, the the different genres and categories of movies have definitely helped people even find an identity mm-hmm. for themselves.
Yeah.
And we need to celebrate that. It's because, again, identity is another big word. And I feel that when we come across movies that give us a part of that, you know, mm-hmm. it's emotionally, it's intense, it's big. It's yeah. hard to explain with words. That's why people make movies in the first place, because yeah. there are things you can't explain with words.
Yeah.
And that's where I feel gratefulness for mm-hmm. the film industry, you know. Mm-hmm. Film industry is still having, you know, finding its own balance, looking at Hollywood and type of movies that are being released and that will be released. Where do you feel the indie film community fits into the whole picture?
Oh man. Well, I mean, I think we're the pioneers, right? And I think, like, in a lot of ways Hollywood is kind of scrambling because they don't really know what audiences want.
Oh, okay. All right. Look at that. Okay.
I mean, we're seeing all these reboots of like old TV shows and it's like we're constantly recycling the same ideas in Hollywood because the budgets are bigger and, you know, a certain amount of money needs to be made because it's also a business. So the indie film scene, I think, gets to be kind of like a testing ground for, you know, new ideas that might be successful. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, it's kind of an exciting place to play. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I've also, you know, just recently sort of discovered in my own filmmaking life is that, you know, sometimes those bigger budget films are less fun. Mm. I feel like the bigger the movie is, you know, the more moving pieces, the more pressure, like there's just so many things that kind of subtract from that pure, you know, indie filmmaking kind of feeling on a set when everyone's there because they're just passionate about movies and they want, you know, to be a part of it.
The film soul.
Yeah.
The film soul. Yeah. What is the experience you remember of the with most pleasure?
Oh boy.
When thinking about the film soul.
The film soul. I did I did a little competition short for something called ABCs of Death, which is a it's like a horror anthology. So there's two versions of it now. There's ABCs of Death 1 and 2, where they curate 25 directors to make a horror short based on a certain letter of the alphabet.
Oh.
And then the 26th one was a competition piece. So like directors from all over the world created their own letter M short and then submitted it, and then people voted, and then the winning one made it into the final anthology.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't win, but we did really, really well, and they created a separate anthology with 26 shorts that were within the competition. Mm-hmm. But when I made that, when my little film family made that short, you know, I think we spent $1,000. We went out into the woods. You know, everyone was volunteer. We shot through the night, and everybody was naked because I was like this cult scene in the woods, and it was just the most fun, playful filmmaking experience I've ever had. We were all there for the love of it, and it just, yeah, I whenever I think of like my favorite kind of film memory, I think that was it.
Wonderful. And it goes back to the community as well, I feel, you know, the people that you make the movie with,
yeah,
that's what's gonna color the experience, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it so magical in the end. Yeah, we'll get to talk a little bit about that even more later, but I feel now it's time to take a break.
Mm-hmm.
And actually I want to ask you, because this is one of my favorite soundtracks and one of my favorite stories overall, and this is The Last of Us, the video game. Why did you choose The Last of Us?
Oh my gosh. The Last of Us is, well, first of all, I think some of the most compelling storytelling is happening in games.
Mm.
And I think The Last of Us is one of the most beautiful games to hit the scene in recent memory. And the music is incredible.
I can agree with that. And I can agree with the fact that so many good stories are being told in video games.
Yeah.
You know what? We'll get to chat a little bit about video games as well after the break. But before then, enjoy. This is the soundtrack of The Last of Us by Gustavo Santaolalla, and this is A New Dawn.
Thank you.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Room Tone, the radio show, and here we are with the phenomenal Nicholas Humphreys talking movies and talking a little bit about video games as well. This was the soundtrack of The Last of Us. What an amazing video game, and the soundtrack by Gustavo Santaolalla. Now, video games are finding their own space in the world of entertainment, and especially storytelling, when we get to that active cinematic experience. What's your take on that, and what's your experience with something like that?
Oh my gosh. Well, I should preface this by saying that I'm not necessarily a gamer. My boyfriend's a huge gamer, and so he plays and I watch.
Okay.
But I just feel like the format of a video game not only allows for a really expansive world building and character development experience, but the fact that you're getting to make the choices of that character creates that just another level of empathy that, you know, you have for that character. We're not a passive audience watching this happen to someone. We're a piece of them. And I think that's just, it provides for really exciting storytelling. And we're seeing that in games like The Last of Us and Life is Strange and the Telltale games like The Walking Dead game,
Don't get me started on that. The narrative and the sense of story behind those projects, it's really at another level. It's basically capturing so much of the audience that is not feeling involved with TV series anymore.
Yeah.
And I feel that we're gonna reach a stage in which that interactivity of video games is gonna match the filmic quality experience. Mm-hmm. We're going to find the common space, or I hope we will find the common space. Do you think we'll find the common space?
I think so, because, you know, like, my generation did not necessarily grow up with these kinds of video games. Like, I didn't get an original Nintendo until I was like 12 years old. So now the generations are growing up with a controller in their hand. And I think, you know, as the technology gets better and the audience is accustomed to playing games, I think, yeah, we're just going to get... It's fusing, and it'll be really exciting to see, you know, what happens over the next 10, 20 years in that regard.
And with actually talking about that, I want to ask you, where do you see yourself in 10 years?
Where do I see myself in 10 years? If everything goes according to plan, I will be living in a cabin in the woods.
All right.
Maybe making a movie, like a straight-to-video-on-demand horror movie a year, and spending a lot of time with my partner and my dog and my cat, and just living life. I think that would be...
Wonderful. What's the name of your dog?
Fergus.
Fergus, awesome. Yeah, it's I love dogs. Dogs, cats, animals have their own way of being as well, you know, and the difference between cats and dogs, you know. Yeah. It's fascinating to see how that's embedded in their nature, you know. Mm-hmm. And the dog, you know, we love you no matter what. I find it so interesting that when you throw the stick, the dog, and then you hide it, you throw the stick and maybe you hide it, right?
Yeah.
The dog still goes for it, because the dog loves you so much and trusts you so much that he would never even be able to imagine that you would fool him like that.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting to see how there is an animal aspect that we are lacking as humans, and there is a human aspect that animals are missing as animals.
Yeah.
It's another big contrast right there. But that was a little bit of a whoop segue move. It was something like, yeah, just letting it out there. And with that being said, I actually want to talk straight away about your web series and your experience with your web series.
Cool. Yeah. So I was a part of this web series back in 2009 that started off as a short film. One of the writers took it to a director. Ryan Coppel, the writer, took it to Kalina Kiff, a director. And she loved it, but she thought it was, you know, we spent 10 pages building a world and not telling a story. So they expanded it into a pilot. We couldn't get any networks to even respond to us because we were just a bunch of film students that had done some short films. And we finally got the good advice to adapt it into a web series, build an audience, and then bring that as a proof of concept with an audience back to the studios. So we shot this web series. It was a steampunk inspired web series called Reese Kingdom Falling, and got millions of views. We promoted it at Comic-Con, and we managed to license it to the Sci-Fi Channel. There was a prequel novel, an iPhone game. We did two seasons.
Wow.
It was recut as a feature. It was on Space Channel in Canada, dubbed into like a bunch of different languages. And the success of that was what helped me make the jump into features, right? Because usually the trouble with short films is that, you know, everybody has one. And in order to get trusted with a budget, you need to prove that you can handle a larger story. And that web series was, you know, the thing that allowed me to show, look, I'm not just a short film guy. I can also tell a story that lasts 45 minutes. give me money to make a feature film.
Mm-hmm. That was the step in the middle.
Yeah.
And what about your first feature film experience?
My first feature film experience. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Man.
We want to hear that. Oh,
yeah. Well, it's called Death Do Us Part, and you can get it pretty much everywhere because it's a very straight up murder mystery in the woods mm-hmm. type slasher film. And we shot for 11 and a half days up on the Sunshine Coast. Really fantastic group of people donating their time and equipment. We shot it for quite a low budget. Yeah, it got out there. It's on DVD. It's on iTunes. It's everywhere. So that was it was really fun. And it was very exciting to be making that first feature.
Mm-hmm. Was it something you wrote?
No. It was written by Ryan Koppel, one of the writers from Reese, and two of the actors, Julie and Peter Benson.
Awesome.
They kind of co-wrote it, and then we went out into the woods for 11 days and mm-hmm. shot like crazy. And yeah.
Because I know you're also a writer, and I would love to explore that layer of your creative soul as well.
You bet. Because
being a writer and director, there is a duality there, and it's interesting. How do you switch between those when you go on set?
Well, I mean, I came to film production and directing because I sort of fell in love with writing and reading first. I lived in books when I was a kid. Some of my favorite experiences as a child were sitting with my nose in a book. Mm. And, you know, there was a while where I wanted to be a writer. Directing wasn't even on the radar. I just found that, you know, when I got exposed to film after I graduated from college and was working at Vancouver Film School, that it was something that I got really excited about, the collaboration aspect of it. So, I mean, I've written and directed a couple of short films, but I really enjoy when you have a bunch of people who are experts of their own crafts, right? You have a writer who's been working that muscle, you know, round the clock, and a director who's focusing on directing, and actors who focus on acting, and you bring all these minds together, all fighting for the best idea, and then the resulting product is better than a sum of its parts. And so, you know, while I would never say that I will never write and direct, I do, when I'm directing, I like working with a script where a writer is in charge of that script.
Hmm. Okay, that's a beautiful walk right there we just had in the park. You know, that was a really interesting section right there, and you know, that opens so many doors. And because when you are a writer and director and an instructor and mentor, you know, having so many different points of view on the same craft of filmmaking and telling stories, mm-hmm. where is that line between filmmaking and the story? You know, when is it necessary to go to the medium of filmmaking instead of just focusing on the story and what the story needs? It's a delicate balance right there as well, huh?
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
The challenge with film is that you know, we're limited by our budgets sometimes. Mm. And sometimes the story requires, you know, a certain thing to happen, but we're only in that location for a day, or, you know, we
yeah.
you know, that we have to make a lot of choices based on time and money. So I think it's what is important to do is look at that script and think about, like, what is the emotional intention behind a story be? What do we want the audience to feel? And then taking that and adapting it to the resources that we have available to us.
Mm-hmm. And that process is not so smooth all the times, right?
No. Sometimes it's a huge failure, but we do our best.
Do you have something in mind based on your own experience?
You know what? When we were doing Reese, the web series, we were in Fort Langley for a day, and we shot something out of sequence. And basically, one thing led to another, and I realized that I had 30 minutes left of daylight in that location to tell, like, 6 pages of script.
Oh, wow.
And it was devastating. It was the biggest thing I'd ever worked on. And I was panicking. There's a picture of me sitting on set with my binder trying to figure out how to solve it. And it makes my stomach lurch whenever I see that photo. But when I looked at it, I had to go through the script and look, and I was like, this is a cat and mouse chase between the protagonist and a bunch of, like, feral children that are trying to kill her. And mm-hmm. so I kind of threw my shot list out the window and talked to my DP. We collaborated on this. And what we did is we stuck a camera at one end of Fort Langley and just had her run towards the camera. And then we had kids hiding off the sides of frames and running in. And after we shot that, I went home feeling like I'd wasted everyone's money and time and I'd ruined everything. When we edited it into the film or into the web series episode, it's my favorite shot in the whole movie.
Mm.
And so sometimes, you know, you get these happy accidents. Things that feel like a mistake or you know, you're being limited by something can result in a really rewarding product. So it's just, yeah, it was like the most devastated I've ever been and yet became one of my favorite moments.
It's interesting to hear that from you, especially because having the experience of working with budgets that you know, even rich, really, really high stakes. You know, there is a lot happening on set when there's so many resources involved. How was your experience with some of the features that had a little bit of a bigger castle behind?
Oh, man. Well, the one that I just shot in Sudbury was like by far the biggest film that I've ever worked on. It was a big sci-fi movie set in space. You know, we were on a spaceship, mm-hmm. and, you know, it was a couple $1 million of someone else's money. And so the stakes were really high. I was having night terrors when I was trying to sleep at night. And I was also really terrified because I've been making movies here in Vancouver with the same film family for like a decade. And there I was working with an entirely new team of people, all who have been making movies with each other. I was like the new part of the equation. You know, I really lucked out because we had this fantastic line producer in Sudbury, a guy named Jason Jelle, who, you know, made an effort to introduce me to everyone, all my key creatives, in a social way before we even got to picture. And so when we arrived for that first day on set, I was suddenly making a movie with all my friends.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the film industry is relatively new in Sudbury. So everybody that are working on those films are all very talented, but, you know, there's no sense of jadedness going on. Everybody's still really excited to be making movies mm-hmm. there. So we had a fantastic time. You know, even though it was like a big budget, high stakes, the experience of making the film was very rewarding.
Such a smart and pleasant experience going there, meeting everybody before actually starting the movie.
Mm-hmm.
That's something, I mean, producers, take note. This is amazing because it really gives you the chance to, gives you the time to adapt.
Yeah.
And it gives the chance to a little bit of it gives time to the family to really solidify around the story.
You work faster, you communicate better. It just, I think it was a really interesting technique to have us do that. And I even wasn't aware he was doing it until we got there. And I was like, hey, I see what you were doing there. That's pretty smart.
Yeah, emotional intelligence. You need this in this industry. Woohoo. Yeah, and all those. And in the end, it's all about feelings, huh? It's all about emotions, you know? Without those, we would just be robots, right?
Yeah.
Everything would be standardized. Is there a specific emotion that identifies your path?
Oh, identifies my path.
As an artist and filmmaker.
Hope.
Ooh, okay.
I guess, yeah.
Hope, seeking that light. And that actually resonates a lot with the Last of Us that we're playing the soundtrack of.
Yeah.
That really resonates with that.
Mm-hmm.
Hope is a big word right there.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I think if I look back at my body of work and I kind of like look at the characters that I sort of identify the most with, it's people who are sort of, you know, at moments, characters who are at moments of change in their life and realize they're not like everybody else. And so, you know, it's the hope to, you know, succeed or I guess survive or, you know, flourish, whatever that means within their world. I think that's, mm-hmm. yeah, I think that's.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say hope.
Oh, yeah, hope. I like that. That okay. light, whoop, splashing through the darkness, you know, definitely something that resonates a lot, especially in our society in 2018.
Yeah.
Because there's so many problems out there, so many imbalances. And that's what movies give us. Movies give us hope
mm-hmm.
to really go and fight against all these unfair things that are happening around the world. So hope is definitely an interesting keyword that you splashed out there. It's definitely well aimed and well shot. And with that, I want to actually transition to casting. Because they say 90% of directing is casting.
Big
I want to hear what you think about that.
Casting. I mean, you know, in the industry, it's industry standard to cast from an audition and a casting session. And it's such a crazy thing to do because you have actors who are better at that at auditions than you know acting sometimes, and you have 10 minutes to figure out if someone is going to be the face of your movie, you know, and that's a big choice to make. And so I would much prefer cast somebody because I've seen something that they've been in and they've, you know, kicked butt, and maybe a reference, you know, phone call to the director and ask, you know, how they were to work with. But, you know, in a casting session, I always look for, you know, even if they give me what I'm looking for the moment they walk in with what they prepared, I'll give them an adjustment to take them in a different direction, even if it's not what I'm looking for, because I want to see how they take that adjustment. And if they can take it and make it feel real, then I know I can work with them on the day.
Mm-hmm.
I've also had the privilege advantage of working with, I mean, a couple of films I've worked with, we've had casts that kind of like came on board because they were going to be a bankable element to that film. And I've had wonderful experiences with that. My second feature, I got to work with Eowyn Rion from Game of Thrones. And he plays such a terrifying character on that show. I was really nervous about meeting him, but he was just very low maintenance mm-hmm. and cool and fun, and then would turn it on and give us these amazing performances. So mm-hmm. yeah, casting's a beast. I think you just need to know what you're looking for.
Yes, that's a good one right there. I mean, good directors, usually there is a saying that good directors are know what they're doing, know what they want.
Yeah. I think it's also really important to keep an open mind in regards to things like gender and race and stuff like that.
Oh, yes.
You may have like come into it with a certain, you know, look in mind, but if you shut those doors, you might be missing an opportunity for something greater.
Oh, yes. Thank you for saying that, because there is and in the past episodes here at Roomtone, we actually had a lot of guests talking about representation.
Mm-hmm.
That is a huge topic. It's deeply important to go and explore all aspects of representation, because characters are not only characters, they represent ideals, they represent communities.
Yeah.
So when a specific character delivers a line, even in a specific way, that can have a whole shift in the way a community even speaks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I feel that goes back to the intensity of the job of the director, you know?
Yeah.
There is a subtlety that becomes majestic later on.
Well, and I also think it's really important to, like, I mean, growing up as a gay kid in a small town in the 90s, you know, like, I didn't see representations of myself on screen.
Mm.
They just didn't exist. And I think, you know, the same is true for, you know, many minorities, right? It's film historically has been very whitewashed. And we create our identities based on, you know, things that we see, right? And so, you know, a lot of us kind of get these, like, stunted development things because we have to find out who we are without the assistance of, you know, things that we're seeing on film and television. So I think we're seeing a huge shift in that right now, and I think that's very exciting. I think, you know, gay kids and Asian kids and you know, kids of all over the spectrum mm-hmm. are now going to have these little, like, positive affirmations that, you know, you're a human person that exists in the world, and there are other people like you, and you're not alone. I think that's just fantastic.
Yes, yes. Woohoo! Oh, yeah, that really resonates again. And I feel that the Vancouver is the perfect place to talk about this
mm-hmm.
because not too long ago I was on a set where everybody from the crew was coming from a different place in the world, like a different country,
mm-hmm.
not even a different, like a different country,
mm-hmm.
you know? And that's something so beautiful and poetic in a way. Everybody coming from a different place under the same roof to tell the same story.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting there. I really feel we're getting there. Where do you see the community in 10 years?
Oh, boy. In 10 years, I think we're going to start to see, like, I think, you know, like, movies like Love, Simon and Crazy Rich Asians and, like, those are not going to be outliers. There's going to be, like, a larger piece of the pie of the things that, you know, we see coming out of Hollywood with big mm-hmm. budgets and being supported and celebrated and stuff like that. I think we're going to, you know, reach just a very colorful equilibrium
mm-hmm.
in the things that we have access to watch and that we get to make, and the voices telling those stories. It's really exciting.
Equilibrium, balance. We always go back to that. It's probably the toughest challenge, maintaining that balance. And with that being said, it's time to take our second break. And right after that, we're going to get to the one-minute pitch.
Oh, geez. Woo-hoo,
we got something to pitch right there. But yeah, this is the soundtrack of Gustavo Santaolalla, You and Me from The Last of Us. Enjoy. Wow, Nicholas, where did that take you?
that took me to that menu screen in The Last of Us, where it's like it feels like you're sitting in a chair just watching the curtain in the window blow, and everything is gone. Everybody's gone and every single thing is gone. And it's just this beautiful, hopeless kind of moment, which isn't even part of the gameplay. That's mm-hmm. that's kind of where that takes me.
Mm-hmm. Projecting yourself into that world.
100%. Yeah.
That's imagination right there.
Yeah.
For writers, directors, who being able to project that in there, it's something that it's fun, and it's also a great muscle, you know, to develop as a storyteller. But with that being said, we're going to go to the 1 minute pitch. Are you ready for that?
I think so.
All right. I'm gonna hit that clock, all right?
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yes.
I'm going in 3, 2, 1.
Okay, so it's Halloween night, 1987, and a group of kids accidentally break this artifact at a museum that unleashes this ancient evil upon their town. And what this evil does is it turns everybody who's dressed up in a Halloween costume into the monsters that they're dressed up in. So this is a monster movie of epic proportions, okay? There's hordes of zombies. There's Draculas. Pretty much every big bad within popular culture in 1987 makes an appearance in this film. It is like Stranger Things meets Ready Player One. And so these kids, they have to survive the night. They have to rescue their parents, and they have to get this evil back into the artifact so that they can survive and live another day. This is a script that was written by Matt Baker and Roz Young based on an idea I had in a corn maze on Halloween night. Give us your money.
Amazing. Look at that, right on time. That's the way you begin a half five, man. That's the way you pitch it. Wow. All right. That's a great idea. Woo. Okay. Well, wow. I'm still imagining all the outcomes and the possibility and the things that you can do with something like that. It's huge.
This is the script that I keep around when the luck hits and some producer's like, hey, I got, you know, millions of dollars to throw at you. Mm-hmm. What is the thing you want to make? That's the script that I want to make.
Amazing.
Because it's a perennial film. It's Halloween. So it's like, it'd become an instant classic, right? People will watch it year after year.
It's very, yes, it is very catchy in the idea already. It is
good.
Very catchy.
Good.
Very interesting.
Maybe somebody heard that and will throw some money at me.
Yeah, right on. All right. And this takes us to the Proust questionnaire.
Fantastic.
And I'm going to ask you, of course, I have to ask you, who are your favorite writers?
Oh, my goodness. Hands down, 100%, Clive Barker is the writer that made me want to be a storyteller. I read Everville and the Great and Secret Show when I was like 12 years old, and it just changed the way I thought about storytelling and world building. And funny story, I actually sent him a link to a short film I did called The Little Mermaid, and he responded. I contacted him through Facebook, and he just said, a lovely film. So now on my website, I've got this quote from Clive Barker on a short film that I did, and it's like one of the most meaningful messages I've ever received.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And what was your experience in that short film?
Oh, man. That was shot in a day in a studio at Vancouver Film School. And that film has actually, you know, it's like of all the things that I've done, that thing has gotten more play than anything else I've ever done, because it won some awards at festivals. And then when we went on YouTube, like it's had over 5 million views on YouTube. So now when I have students coming in and I'm showing them, you know, like things that I've done in my demo reel and stuff, they've all seen that short film. And it just goes to show that like short films can actually get you a ton of visibility if you can connect with that audience.
It's all about that idea. It's all about finding that key.
Yeah, and mermaids are really popular, apparently. Like, people really love stuff about mermaids.
Right on. Awesome. And with that, we're going to moonwalk to the second question of the Proust questionnaire. And it is, what do you consider your greatest achievement?
My greatest achievement? You know what? I think from where I'm at right now, I was a starving artist for a very long time. And so I learned to live my life within a certain budget. And when I shot my last feature, you know, I got paid to make that film, and I was able to buy a house about 5 hours north of Vancouver, and because that has been a dream that I've had my entire life, of owning, you know, my own house, and it's not something that's available to us within Vancouver, but being able to buy that place with my partner. We started, when we got together, we were sleeping on an air mattress in a 400 square foot studio apartment that had an ant issue. And, you know, 6 years later, we have our own property, you know, and our own little piece of forest and paradise. And I just
awesome.
Think that's
that. Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
That's awesome right
yeah.
there. Woo! All right. Third question of the Proust questionnaire. This is a little bit deeper. What is your greatest fear?
Home invasion.
Okay.
Awesome. I there lose you go. So many there sleepless nights thinking someone's going to come in and get me. I don't know. It's mm-hmm. yeah.
There you go. All right.
Might not be as deep as
that's a great answer right there. All right. All right. Okay. All right. Fourth question of the Proust questionnaire. Who are your heroes in real life?
Oh, Guillermo del Toro.
Ooh.
If I could be like any director, he's kind of my idol. But as far as like real life heroes go, like right now too, like I think shout out to the BC Wildfire Service, the men and women that are fighting the wildfires in BC mm-hmm. right now and putting their lives on the line, doing, you know, some really important work and receiving a ton of criticism online for not doing it the right way. Like I think, you know, those are some heroes that I mm-hmm. have right now.
Those are the people you most admire
at this moment. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's just, I think they're doing really important, scary, dangerous work.
I see.
And they deserve our respect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, there is a lot that goes into it. I actually had a friend who did that, and there is so much work that goes into it.
Yeah.
Physical, mental. Shout out to everybody who actually does their best to keep us safe.
Yeah.
In general, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah. We can't take it for granted, you know.
Yeah.
It's huge. It's big, and that's we got to be very grateful every single day.
Yeah.
Just as we are today, enjoying the beautiful sun here in Vancouver.
Yeah, yeah.
It's beautiful to be here, and it's beautiful to be about to wrap up this whole episode. Before we wrap it up, I still have a couple of questions from the Proust questionnaire.
For sure.
And this one goes, which historical figure do you most identify with?
Oh, boy.
That's a tough one. But
that
it's
a tough
very
one.
Very interesting, yeah.
Oscar Wilde.
Woo! All right. Awesome right there. That was easy though. You thought about it a little bit, but then it just came out. It was really natural.
Yeah.
I like that. I really like that. And that takes us to the last question of the Proust questionnaire. What is your idea of perfect happiness?
Oh, perfect happiness for me is a lazy Sunday up at my house with the windows open where I can hear the birds and I can see the trees, and I'm with my boyfriend and my dog and my cat, and we're watching cartoons and eating whatever the hell we like. That's
awesome.
Perfect happiness to me.
Awesome. There you go. What's your favorite food?
My favorite food? I'm going to say sushi.
Mm-hmm.
Mexican food being a close runner-up.
Okay, awesome right there. Have you been to Mexico?
Many times,
okay.
Yeah, I'm going back in February, actually.
Oh, there you go, that's awesome right yeah. there. Traveler, what is the place you like the most in the whole world?
I've been going to Puerto Vallarta since I was a little kid with my family, so it's the place I go back to because I know where everything is. You know, I know how to get around. It's a beach town.
Mm-hmm.
It's, yeah. But I do want to go and explore and actually experience some culture. I have a lot of Mexican friends having worked at Vancouver Film School. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I could do a driving tour of Mexico and have places to stay in every single little town. And
awesome.
One
right
of these
there.
Days I'll do that trip.
Yeah. Awesome. It's interesting talking about that sense of detachment from the work. There's a balance between rest and work.
Yeah.
What's your take on that?
I think it's really important. Like, you know, I spent so much of my 20s just working on becoming a better filmmaker. And I feel like the things that actually made me a better storyteller was going out and living life and having life experiences. And I feel like if you can't shut off and go have adventures outside of film, it's going to be harder to have stories to tell inside of film. So I think it's really important, you know, to have that work-life balance. And filmmaking is, you know, your life, and it has to be. But I think it's also really important to go out and have other interests mm-hmm. and do things to relax and manage your anxiety, if you're me, like my crazy anxiety. So you got to, like, you know, have those quiet times.
How do you balance that? When is the time you say, I need to go? I need to just detach? Or when is the time, I need to go back and make a move, I need to go back to work?
I just will be very clear about what my boundaries are, I think, now. You know, I will never shirk an obligation. If I sign up for something, I will give it 110% until it's done. And once it's done, I will give myself the required amount of time to decompress.
Mm-hmm.
So my last feature was 2 years ago. I'll probably be ready to tackle another one in 6 months to a year.
Mm-hmm.
But,
do you have something in mind?
Yeah, I'm actually, I'm working on a script with a screenwriter named Margaret Lockyer, and she's writing something. This is sort of a step forward and a step back, but It's a film that we can shoot with the resources that we have available to us. You know, we're not shooting outside our budget. It's two actors acting, three actors acting in one location. It is a thriller. It's in my genre, but I want to go back and shoot a feature where the stakes are lower. I feel like that's where I'm going to get to be able to say something, you know, noteworthy and impactful, you know, where there isn't a ton of stakes and we can just be creative and, you know, not have to deliver a product for the widest possible audience.
Where is your heart now? Your creative heart.
My creative heart. I want to continue doing features, but I want to, you know, like for a lot of years, I was having to say yes to everything. When you have an opportunity, you say yes. And now I feel like the pressure's off a little bit. I've got three feature films under my belt, and I'm going to only say yes if the story is there and the conditions are right and it's the people I want to work with. I've got a little bit more freedom to say yes to the right project now, which is, it's an exciting place to be.
Mm-hmm. And that's something that you conquer with a lot of time and work.
Yeah.
And that's something that comes to my mind when I think about Nicholas Humphreys, you know, and when we, as you know, alumni or students talk about you as an instructor, mentor, director, we always talk with light in our eyes, you know.
Aww.
Because of the passion that you share.
Thank you.
And because of the help that you give. Every time someone needed help, you were there, and that creates trust, and that's something that I feel you have to be very happy and proud of. Because people resonate with that. People create a link with that. And they will remember.
Well, thank you for saying
people,
that.
People remember that. You know, people don't forget. That's the most important thing I wanna wrap this whole episode up with. Because people don't forget. Nobody forgets, especially feelings and emotions.
Hmm.
We might forget what people say, but we will never forget how people make us feel.
Are you trying to make me cry?
No. It's like, no. But we're here, and with that, I want to ask you one last question before we wrap this whole burrito up, and that's, what's your advice to filmmakers?
Oh, my advice to filmmakers. You know what? Fight your way through it. I think I said that earlier, but like, everybody starts somewhere, and you know, if you're willing to put in the time and the energy and you could acknowledge, you know, where you need to grow, everybody can get where they're going, and don't have a plan B, and take the work seriously, but don't take yourself too seriously.
The work seriously, but don't take yourself too seriously.
Yeah.
Ooh, I really like that. That's awesome. And with that, we are wrapping up the 29th episode of Room Tone here at CITR 101.9 FM. We're going to put the link of your website in the description of this podcast so that everybody can take a look at what you're doing. And any shout outs?
Shout outs to my boyfriend, award-winning costume designer, Brandon Peterson, who is on set today in the studio with his costume team on a weekend working hard. I love ya.
Awesome. Let's make more movies, more and more and more movies here in the beautiful sunny Vancouver. This is the soundtrack of The Last of Us. Thank you, Nicholas.
Thank you.
And see you next Monday. Thank you.
crime racketeer. Back in full force.
This could be one of the big moments in your life. Don't make it your last.
Look, this thing might be bigger than even we think it is.
Do you need an upgrade to the soundtrack to your life? Perhaps a song from a film or a tune from TV? My name is Gap. Exploding Head Movies is here to give you sounds from the cinema, along with the songs that will be defining your future, and those forgotten classics that need a little rescue. Exploding Head Movies, Monday, 7 to 9 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Join Team PowerSmart. Set an energy conservation target of 10%. You'll get access to tools to help you conserve, and you can track your progress online. Visit bchydro.com/Team PowerSmart to join today. This message brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
The UBC Women in Science Club provides support for female undergraduates in science fields. Our club has three pillars: mentorship, building community, and connecting people. We offer networking events with alumni, professional development workshops, as well as an ongoing mentorship program to support students through challenges that arise for women pursuing careers in science.
This is CITR 101.9